The ABS says payroll jobs are now back at the same level they were pre-pandemic, and we might even see unemployment go down to 5% this year. If you lost your job or you're in an industry that's still struggling, you might do a double take at that idea. Or you might be wondering how to choose a job, a career, an occupation, however temporary, that's going to be a bit more future-proof than the one you used to have. If you did have to transition to a new career or industry, how did you do it? What helped you to make that change? I'd love to hear your story on the Radio National Facebook page. Today on Life Matters, we're going to take a bit of time to look at the post-pandemic workforce and how you match people and skills and jobs for everyone's benefit. We'll hear from some people who've been forced to change careers and where that took them, and we'll ask how low unemployment should go. Let's start first, though, by asking what's actually going on in the jobs market after last year's upheaval. Professor Phil Lewis is an economist and director of the Centre for Labour Market Research at the University of Canberra. Phil, welcome to you.
Morning.
Now, in March and April last year, almost 600,000 people lost their jobs, young workers disproportionately. Can we really have emerged so fast and so well from that recession?
I think it's true to say that most people, I think, have been very surprised by how resilient the economy has been. A lot of people were forecasting that we were going to have quite a deep recession and a fairly long recession as it took time to recover. So it's been a surprise to everybody. And I think the reason is because this recession is not like no other we've had before. Most recessions have been caused by a falling in demand, people not buying things from the shops, general fall in world trade, etc. This one has basically been totally constructed by the government telling businesses not to operate. And that's for health reasons, of course, very good health reasons, but it's the first time really that businesses have been told they can no longer sell their products. And the point is, I suppose, when the government relaxes that and says, okay, now you can go back to business, businesses have shown how resilient they are in coming back to where they were before. So that's I think that's the difference this time.
It's been an amazingly quick recovery to get unemployment back down to the rate it is now. And Phil, the participation rate was key to how rosy those figures were, wasn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about why that's so encouraging?
The point is the unemployment rate is a concoction of lots of different things going on. It depends on how many people are looking for work, how many people have given up looking for work, how many jobs there are available, etc. And so there's a whole mixture of things going on. But what we're seeing is that Of course, the participation rate has been growing steadily over time. There's more and more part-time jobs, which has largely been responsible for that growth, because a lot of people are coming into the labour market who couldn't previously. People had to look after children, take the kids to school, students. These are all people who now come into enter the market who weren't able to do before, and even older workers, because there's very little physical jobs anymore, and so the physical strength required to enter the labour force is a lot less than it used to be.
Interesting. We're speaking with Professor Phil Lewis, an economist and director of the Centre for Labour Market Research at the University of Canberra, trying to get our head around what has happened with the job market since the big lockdowns for COVID. Phil, have all the jobs we lost just come straight back, or are they different jobs, different places, different sectors, different rates of pay, for example?
We must be careful here. A lot of the sectors haven't recovered. For instance, the main one, I suppose, is tourism, hasn't recovered and is unlikely to recover until basically there's a very strict or comprehensive vaccination program, not just here, but in the rest of the world. And so tourism and all of those things associated with it, like accommodation and hotels, etc., they're still suffering. The arts have largely suffered because, of course, there's been no theatres open, and the pubs where most musicians used to gain their income have been forced to very strictly limit the number of people. They can't have dancing, they can't have shoulder-to-shoulder audiences like you used to have. So they've been quite hard hit, but they're starting to come back. They're starting to come back, but obviously not as fast as the rest of the economy.
Yes, it will be really interesting to see what the impact of international flights resuming has on a lot of our industries. What about the part-time versus full-time equation? How's that looking these days?
Well, a lot of the recovery has been in part-time work, but part-time work has always been pretty important anyway, and it's particularly important in those industries which have been really strong growth areas, like hotels, accommodation, cafes, restaurants, retail. Those are the ones that where casual work and part-time work is more prevalent, and those are the ones partly where the jobs were lost, because of course all the cafes and restaurants closed, and when the recovery came, of course that's where all the growth occurred. And it's largely because those industries are so flexible in terms of employment. You know, if you're in manufacturing, you can't just turn the production lines off and on. And in agriculture, you can't stop looking after animals and tending crops. But you can, you see, in the service sector, it's fairly easy, for instance, for a restaurant to close down and fairly easy to start back up again. And so that's why we can see these rather rapid increases in unemployment and also quite quick recovery afterwards.
What might happen, Phil, when international workers are allowed to come back into Australia? How might that change the landscape?
I think there's a bit of a myth about the overseas workers. There's basically two types. There's your backpacker overseas students who are largely employed in the less skilled sectors of the economy, cafes, restaurants, taxis, things like that. But there's also a very important role for highly skilled labour, particularly in things like medicine, higher education, science, and finance. These are all areas which, and mining in particular, they desperately want highly skilled people from the rest of the world. And so I think what we'll see is that we're seeing shortages occurring now. Those shortages are going to exacerbate. And the other thing is, of course, that migrants don't just bring labour with them and take people's jobs. They don't do that at all. They actually create wealth in the economy. And so it's, you know, basically people come here and work. They actually create their own wealth to employ themselves. So just about everybody in the economy benefits from having a strong migration program.
And Phil, just finally, when we look at the people who are unemployed, and particularly the groups that remain unemployed even when things get better for other sectors, who are they and why are they struggling to find work?
Well, the research on this is quite clear. It's been fairly obvious for a long while, and that is the biggest single indicator whether you're going to find yourself unemployed is when you left school. So we find most unemployment amongst those people who left school at age 15. They tend to be younger workers who have no work experience, and they tend to be older workers who had skills in dying industries and are not really required in the new service-based economy. And so when we talk about unemployment, basically there's at any one time, there's vacancies for jobs and there's a queue of unemployed people wanting to take those. And employers select people from the queue who they think would be the best employees. And usually the things they look at is, okay, their education levels, their personal skills, and importantly, have you worked before? Because these are all signals to an employer that you're going to be a good worker, as opposed to somebody who has left school at 15, has no work experience, etc., etc. So those are the major factors that affect whether you're going to be unemployed or not.
So when we start looking at how low the unemployment figure could go, is there always going to be a group of people who aren't in work and will struggle to get work, or can you actually create opportunities for people?
Well, the Australian economy, most people don't seem to remember, well, they're probably old enough to remember, but in the 1970s, unemployment very rarely got above 2%. And they sometimes call that the natural rate of unemployment, because at any one time, there's always going to be some people looking for new jobs, etc. And there's some people who are, you know, who probably have impairments to them getting jobs. But now that seems to have risen to something like 4.5%. The estimate varies. Currently, the Reserve Bank governor is saying he thinks it should be lower than that, a bit lower than that. But it's still quite a high figure. And I put it down to the fact that a lot of the jobs that people used to be able to get for the unskilled people used to be able to get just don't exist anymore. The technological change has taken away a lot of the low-skilled jobs in manufacturing and building, and in clerical work in particular. The new technologies have obliterated a lot of the low-skilled clerical jobs like filing clerks, things like this. And in fact, if you go to most offices now, and I imagine it's the same at yours, you're probably doing your own typing and you're preparing your own scripts, etc. Yeah, whereas before that would have been done by a low-skilled clerical person.
Wow. And
I think I was talking to your producer said about there's no such thing as a typist anymore, and she didn't know what a typist was.
I'm very glad for Year 9 typing classes, I have to say. So you're right, there's been this shift away from those low-skilled roles, and you can see how that can really shape up to have intergenerational effects. Phil, it's been fascinating looking at this landscape with you this morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Professor Phil Lewis, an economist and director of the Centre for Labour Market Research at the University of Canberra. You're listening to Life Matters, and we're having a good, hard look at the labour market today, what the future of it might look like, and where you might fit in. We'd love to hear from you if you've had to transition to a new career or industry. How did you go about that? What steps did you take, and what kind of thinking had to go into that? We'd love to hear what helped you make the change. Head to the Radio National Facebook page. That is the new home of Life Matters on Facebook, and tell us your story there. Let's look a little bit further at this idea of the skills shortages and where those skills need to be matched to. Nicholas Wyman is the CEO of the Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation. He's written widely about matching people to skills and then to jobs. His upcoming book is called Ready, Steady, Reset: The Post-COVID-19 Future of Work. Nick Wyman, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning.
So we've heard about the people who are unemployed, even in this weirdly bounced back post-COVID economy. Do you agree with Phil Lewis that the post-COVID economy might look a lot like the pre-COVID economy?
Not entirely. Not entirely. I think that the COVID-19 crisis has created this unprecedented upheaval. And I'm certainly not an economist, but I think that some of the statistics and the figures that are coming through at the moment are not taking into account this period of economic uncertainty and the fact that Australia's borders are closed, that there's been a lot of stimulus. You touched on with Phil this idea of the absence of skilled migrants. So there's all these things, including the disruption of supply chains, getting certain components into Australia. There's all these different variables and factors going on at the moment. So I think I don't think we've seen the end of it.
And you talk about particular sectors that might have seen some changes. I think automotive and technology, some of them. Tell us a bit about how things are shifting there.
Well, look, absolutely. So we've seen an interesting change. I think a lot of people who were either working remotely got into artisan skills and developed those at home. There was that mad rush for chicken coops and people were making bread. But out in the workforce, couriers, messengers, food and beverage moved from physical to, takeaway, and people are rethinking their models quickly. Also in retail, but, medical equipment, information processing, pharmaceutical, and, a real surprise was actually automotive, the automotive sector. People are wanting to service their vehicles and are looking for a reliable vehicle. So, there's people in that sector who've actually seen a growth.
That's really, that makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because people are nervous about using public transport. They might be dusting off the old vehicle. We're speaking with Nick Wyman, who's an employment expert, CEO of the Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation, and his latest book is called Ready, Steady, Reset: The Post-COVID-19 Future of Work. It's really interesting when you kind of push aside the raw figures and look at what that actually means for different groups of people. When you add humans to the statistics, let's meet one of those humans who had to reset her life last year, and we'll talk more with Nick about skills matches and mismatches in a moment. Susie worked as a flight attendant for 30 years, but that all changed during COVID. Susie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning, Hilary. Thanks for having me.
Now, when it became clear that you were going to have to make a switch, what went through your mind?
Initially, complete absolute shock when we heard things were changing, this big thing called COVID was on its way and things were impacting, slowly trickling down. And I thought, no, we're going to be okay, we're going to be fine. And, you know, we'd survived SARS and we'd survived 9/11 and, you know, the industry, the airline industry is going to be okay. And then we realised it was actually really quite serious. And finally getting that letter of you've been stood down, I just remember sitting there going, wow, this is real. It was just a complete reset, really. I was like, oh my gosh, it's happening. It's really happening.
So, yeah. You had a good 2 weeks in quarantine to sit and reflect on your options.
I think when we were actually on a personal holiday in India, we'd been to the Taj Mahal the day before, and the next day we went back again because it was just so magical, and it was actually shut. And the Indian people there were just absolutely in shock, and they were like, this is the first time it's been shut in forever. And that's what made me think, wow, okay, this is really serious. We need to get home. And then I got the letter and it was really, really serious by then.
Well, and it was lucky too that you had an alternative career that you'd been doing beforehand. You'd been doing nursing years and years before.
Correct.
What did it take for you though, once you decided that's where you wanted to be, to get back into nursing, Susie?
Well, I was lucky working for Qantas. They did have some business partners, and the Cruise of Our Own Lifehouse in Sydney was looking for people, and I thought, wow, I've got these skills. I can dust them off. I can get them back out. I loved nursing when I was nursing, and I managed to submit my resume. After submitting resumes to other places around, that got knocked back and then got into Chris O'Brien and worked there as an assistant in nursing. So I wasn't registered anymore. I was actually an assistant in nursing. But when I started work there, it was just wonderful. It was like coming back home and really just appreciating the life I had, but appreciating I've got to get on. I've got skills that I can use in the community. I've got skills that I can, and, you know, fall back on. So I was very lucky. Yes, you're right.
Well, and it's wonderful to hear that you found this safe harbour that's such a great way to use those skills. But Susie, it also sounds like in the lead up to that, you were applying for jobs, you were hearing you had too good people skills, you didn't have good enough people skills. It sounded like you had a lot of hurdles to get over.
Yes.
What helped you deal with that? Was it a particular attitude, or how'd you get through?
Look, I do think it is a particular attitude. I thought I always have a cup half full mentality. I always have a can-do attitude. And after having my 2 weeks of quarantine, I had a lot of self-reflection and looking at the resume, looking at what I had to do, working for Qantas has given me many, many life skills and great customer service. And I knew that I could make use of that. But yes, I did apply for a major liquor chain here. They said that I wasn't customer service focused enough, but I applied for a major banking chain and they said, oh no, you're too customer focused. And I was like, oh my gosh. And then I thought, I know where I need to be. I need to be nursing. I need to help my community. I was watching people become more and more distressed, and there was Facebook groups set up, and I said, listen, I posted my story about getting knocked back twice for two different reasons, but I was going to do the same reason. And I said, don't lose faith, keep going. I'm getting my resume, I'm putting it out there again. And people contacted me saying, thank you, that's what I needed to hear. I needed to hear that I was, you know, there's other people out there getting knockbacks, but then they're still dusted off and managed to right the ship. And I just think the cup half full mentality, the can do attitude, and I knew I had skills and I knew I had the ability, but I wanted to make a difference in my community. I can't go overseas clearly and help people overseas, but I can make a difference here. And I knew the skills that I had and my life experiences that I had, I could actually hone them in and make use of them here.
Yep, it's wonderful to hear that that's how it's worked out for you. Susie, thanks so much for sharing that with us today on Life Matters.
Thank you, Hilary. Thanks for having me.
Susie works at Chris O'Brien Lifehouse now as a nursing assistant. If you had to transition to a new career or an industry, how did you do that? What helped you to make that change? Was it some structural support or just a resilience in your attitude? We'd love to hear about it on the Radio National Facebook page. Nick Wyman, Susie had to jump through quite a few hoops and be very resilient. Is that what we're in for? Is that illustrative of what it's like right now to try to transition to a new career?
Look, absolutely. Susie's not alone. A lot of Australians have been forced to reconsider fundamentals of how they work. And it does sound like a few employers missed out on some great candidates. And I think that it really is both a time for, you know, people looking for work, but also employers to reevaluate. And I really liked the steps that Susie took, which was this personal skills audit. And, you know, although it wasn't formal, you know, she went through and looked at the things that she'd been able to do in her, you know, former jobs or former roles, and see how she could pivot that. And that's a fantastic way, because quite often, you know, people move from one, you know, job to a similar job or a similar sounding role, and that is sort of bounce along. And I think this really has caused people to, you know, sit back and actually reflect, and particularly for those who are caught in quarantine, and able to say, you know, what is important to me, what makes me happy, and really start to look forward from that position.
We're speaking with Nick Wyman, employment expert, CEO of the Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation, and his book's called Ready, Steady, Reset, the Post-COVID-19 Future of Work. We're taking a broad look today on Life Matters at the job market post-COVID and what it might mean for you if you're considering changing your field of work and hoping that you're getting something that's going to be future-proof in some sense, going to be able to adjust whatever the future might bring. Joe Yates took some time out to reflect and work out what would be useful and enjoyable in her life too. She was a film producer and her work dried up very fast once the pandemic hit. Joe, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, you'd been through the GFC. Did that help you work out what was going on this time and what you needed to do?
Yeah, so I was also working in the same industry during the GFC, and what tends to happen is as soon as something like that hits, a lot of companies stop spending on their marketing. So I'd already been through it once and had to change careers slightly then. So when this started, I knew that, you know, my work was going to dry up pretty quickly. And that's exactly what happened. So I'd been running my own company and working for myself for about 7 years, and everything just dried up straight away. We literally couldn't film. There were so many restrictions in place that you couldn't, with the social distancing, you actually couldn't get close enough to people to film. And on top of that, everyone was trying to save their advertising budgets, I think, to kind of evaluate what was going on before they started spending again. So I knew it was coming because I'd been there before.
So how did you decide where you wanted to be, Joe, and how to get there?
So during that time, I'd actually moved out of Sydney as well. So I was in a quite fortunate position where I didn't have the huge financial stress of a big Sydney mortgage or rental, you know, thing to make each week. So I had the great opportunity to just take a little time to reflect. What I'd been doing as well as producing for the last 10 years was actually renovating properties. So that's something I loved and I really, really enjoyed. So I decided that I would look at that skill. So similar to what your previous caller was saying, you know, having a bit of a skills audit. Throughout those 10 years, I'd always had people, friends and colleagues coming to me and asking me, you know, for advice on buying and selling houses and renovating. So I obviously knew that there was a skill that I had that people wanted. So I decided to focus on that more.
And you doing that now, you've got a new business, that's great.
Yeah.
I think you had to get your real estate license, but no massive amount of training. Is this where you've landed forever, Joe, or do you think you might pivot again in the future?
Who knows? you just never know what's coming.
Exactly.
So I love it. I've really enjoyed it. It's very similar skill set to producing, as in, you know, it's project management, it's time management, it's budget management. So that's a core skill that I have that I can take to different kind of industries. So this is something I love at the moment, and I hope to keep doing it. And I love helping people, you know, visualise what they can do with their property and actually create something beautiful that they're going to love living in. So, yeah, hopefully I will be doing it for the foreseeable future, but I'm not going to say forever because you just never know.
Yes, indeed. Might jinx it. Joe, thanks so much and all the best for the future.
Thank you.
Jo Yates doing what she loves, which is what we'd all love to do. Nick Wyman, it's interesting to hear from Jo that, you know, she had these two things going on at the same time. And I've heard you say that the future of work might be about having these multiple irons in the fire at one point. I've heard it called multiple job holding. That sounds really stressful and time consuming. Are we all effectively going to be freelancers in the coming world?
Well, I think that... that particularly with Jo's story, she looked at how, you know, how to turn, you know, the crisis into opportunity. And I think it's really important not to think about job titles because, you know, before COVID and if anything, the COVID period has really accelerated the pace of technological change, that a lot of jobs and are going to disappear. And you talked with Phil about, you know, some of the low-skilled, repetitious, dangerous types of work that is going to go away. But for each of those jobs that goes away, there's going to be something new and something interesting and innovative that comes online. And so I really, you know, urge people that they need to develop, you know, skills and a growth mindset and, you know, really, you know, be ready for what the future holds. And to embrace technology and not fear technology. And, you know, a side subset is people, you know, often ask me or always asking me, particularly for their children, you know, if my, you know, son or daughter is not studying STEM in high school, are they not going to get a job? Mm. And I think that, you know, future jobs aren't just about STEM. I think we've been in a bit of a STEM pre-COVID, we're in a bit of a STEM frenzy. And I think that there are a lot of opportunities out there, and you particularly mentioned humankind, and that is something that really has seen us through, you know, some pretty stormy seas, and I think we're going to see that coming through in a lot of occupations, and particularly back to, you know, Susie's story about nursing and caring for people. You know, I think that, you know, there's going to be a lot of industries that we're going to see actually increase.
It's really interesting to see that they were both a bit surprised by how transferable their skills were. You know, I took care of people in the air, now I take care of people on the ground. I did production and now I kind of produce people's homes, from Susie and Jo respectively. But, I mean, what Susie and Jo also had in common was a bit of time and a bit of financial wiggle room to think about their options and to make a considered choice. If you don't have that, where should you start?
Well, look, absolutely. I mean, they both, you know, were in you know, relatively fortunate situations, as you said, where they had time to, you know, in a way, sit back and work out what made them happy and, you know, were able to leverage off or create a new niche or something that they felt was going to be important. For a lot of people, they, you know, are in the situation where they suddenly find out that, you know, their job no longer exists pretty much, you know, on a Friday afternoon. And they're in the position where they need to go out and secure employment. And, you know, they're not in the position to be able to, you know, undertake an audit like that. They really just need to be able to, you know, pay their rent or, you know, be able to, you know, keep their vehicle running and keep their families moving. So I think it's important for people to be really proactive in this space. People have got a fair idea about, you know, industries that are changing rapidly. I mean, we talked a lot about tourism and hospitality is changing, and I don't think it will ever be the same again. Just when the international borders open up, I know a lot of people in the restaurant industry who have felt that, you know, maybe a fixed location is not the best way to run a business. So I'm urging people to take a, you know, a personal long-range view and look at their industry. But it is really tough if you're in a situation where, you know, you find out at short notice that your job no longer exists. I suppose you really just need to, you know, take on some work wherever you can get it. Hopefully in an industry that's close to an industry you might like to work in. And one thing that we have learned, you know, particularly in the last year, is that the whole education landscape is changing. And, you know, for Australia, that's an industry that really has, you know, has been under siege with the decline of, you know, international students coming into Australia. There was a lot of people who were involved in that sector and sadly lost their jobs. But what it's also represented as a lot of this learning has gone online is that people can, you know, in their homes can actually take on some additional studies. And there's all sorts of ways that people can do that. And there's just some incredible apps and resources that, you know, do not cost anything, that people can actually, you know, explore and do research and see if, you know, do some research and find out if that's an industry they'd like to work in.
I was reading earlier about a woman who had no experience in coding but lost her job during COVID, and there were lots of free online courses in coding. So now she's a coder. It's fantastic. I was speaking with Nick Wyman, who's the author of Ready, Steady, Reset, The Post-COVID-19 Future of Work, and he's CEO of the Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation. And we heard from Professor Phil Lewis before about this skills mismatch, this kind of stubborn lack of workers in particular fields, but also we still have 800,000 people unemployed. What can we do about that, Nick? Are we going to be able to match those particular 800,000 people with the jobs available, or do we need to do more to create opportunities for those people?
Look, absolutely. And I think that, you know, if we go back to, you know, to Susie's story, I don't want to harp on the point, but we heard some of the feedback that she was receiving from employers to say, you've got too much of, you've got not enough of. But, you know, probably she would have, you know, ticked most of the boxes, and, you know, all of those companies and all of those industries with some sort of structured training would have been able to, you know, adapt or hone her skills. And they would have had a fantastic employee because she had a very positive, you know, can-do attitude, which is, you know, one thing that's really important to employers. So I think this is, you know, not only an opportunity for, you know, individuals, it's also an opportunity for companies to really think about who it is they might want to employ and really rethink about their hiring practices. I know that a lot of companies have actually gone to genuinely gone to hiring at the local level in the communities. And what I mean by that is, the hiring decisions. So, you know, we had all this sort of, centralized hiring. And I think that, you know, with people being unable to travel and the restriction of movement, that there was a lot of, you know, a lot of people working closer to home.
Yes, indeed. We've had one text say rather dryly, there's plenty of can-do attitudes that don't get the job, and they're pointing out that there might be bigger structural issues at play, like low literacy levels, or as you mentioned before, lack of educational opportunities that people need to address or needs to be addressed structurally. And I guess this is one of the big questions you must get a lot, Nick Wyman. We talked a bit earlier about that idea that there's a lot of jobs in STEM. If you're looking at training and looking at where you might have your long-term, long-range view land, what are some of the industries that we can say with some confidence are going to be in demand as this century unfolds?
Look, obviously, you know, IT very broadly. So, you know, all sorts of different IT-based careers. Healthcare, health and personal services. And in the short term, I must say, there's a lot of paperwork. So a lot of companies are employing people to, you know, fill in forms and online forms. And so I know we talked about administration roles going away. I actually know a lot of companies who are actually having to take on people to deal with the amount of paperwork to, you know, access or unlock or just manage, you know, manage some of these subsidies. But, you know, one thing I just did want to say, who I didn't say before, was that I think, you know, back to, you know, employers and thinking about what employers can do, you know, grassroots training programs, and to the text you received, it really is difficult for some people. You know, they... you know, people have a can-do attitude, but isn't it crazy that it's not showing up? The statistics that we heard from Phil don't seem to be reflective of what I'm seeing in the workplace. There's a lot of people who would like to be working full-time, a lot of people who feel they're in jobs that are going to disappear. And a great way, you know, a great way, and I'm an advocate of the apprenticeship, the Australian apprenticeship system. Apprenticeships are a great way for, you know, both employees and employers to engage in a really structured way with the world of work. So I think, you know, if there's a message to government, I think we really need to have a look at that sector and see how we can, well, when I say a sector, we should really look at how the government can continue to grow and expand this idea of earning and learning.
Yes, and perhaps putting some more resourcing into the education and training sector might create jobs there, but also in the future. Nick Wyman, it's been really interesting having such a deep look at the labour market today. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on the program.
It's a pleasure. Nicholas Wyman, employment expert, CEO of the Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation. He has several books under his belt, and the latest is Ready, Steady, Reset, the post-COVID-19 future of work. I wonder if, as the unemployment figure goes down, the value placed on particular employees might go up. We shall see.